With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello and welcome to a very special last episode 100 of the Cost Per Point Cast. Yes, we finally made it to 100. I'm your host, Trevor Shackles. And joining me for one last time is friend of the show, Ian Mendez, who has been dealing with this wicked storm in Ontario recently. Ian, first of all, I really hope everyone's okay over there, and we've sort of had our own ordeal just trying to get this podcast set up. But second of all, thanks so much for taking some time out of your day. I know there's been a lot going on over there.
Yeah, you know what? There has been, and as frustrating and as it is for me and my family to be without power, without hot water, electricity, internet, you know, all those things. You know, we took a drive around our neighborhood a couple of days. What are we? Sunday or Monday, and you know, to see the devastation in the homes that are damaged, the schools that are damaged, trees, roads. We actually feel lucky. So I know just before we started recording, I was venting to you about being angry and upset. That's probably just a function of me being, you know, agitated and, you know, not having, you know, the things I'm used to having, like internet service and, you know, charged up phones, whatever. But I hope I didn't come across as being ungrateful, because I'm like, I'm super, super grateful that I'm not spending my days speaking to an insurance adjuster or trying to figure out how to get a new car, or figure out, you know, all these things that people are are dealing with in our city right now. It's been a really, look, 2022 has been a really tough year in our city, with the convoy, with, you know, now this storm and COVID, and, you know, just it feels like it's a never ending wave sometimes of stuff that's gone on. But at the same time, I do think it's brought our community closer, and I can't believe the amount of people that have reached out to me and my family to help us. You know, we've gone to people's houses for meals. You know, Brent Wallace, who people know from the Wally and Mathot podcast, longtime broadcaster. Brent Wallace actually came to my house yesterday with a gas generator. And that's how we're doing this podcast, Trevor, is because of Brent. Hat tip to Brent Wallace for bringing me a gas generator. Otherwise, I would have had no internet, no computer, no power, nothing.
Gotta love Wally. And, you know, I just got to say, like, I said this to you before the podcast, but just for the listeners, I mean, this just shows your dedication. I mean, I certainly would have been fine if we had to move this podcast to a later date and stuff. But man, you're just really appreciate the dedication. And yeah, as you were saying, obviously there's a lot of people out there with, you know, some devastation to deal with. So my heart goes out to the people of Ottawa, and hopefully, well, I mean, not even just Ottawa, just Ontario and Quebec in general. And hopefully if you're listening out there that your things are okay and, you know, able to be fixed. And yeah, it's been a rough time, but yeah, shout out to Wally for giving that generator, and you know, we can record this episode 100 here.
Yeah, exactly. Listen, it's pretty cool that you reached out to me. I know this is a significant episode for you, number 100, and you know, sounds like it. Now, is this it for you? Like, this is 100, you're done?
Yeah. So I mean, I'll say this in the outro as well, but I think it's pretty much like a long hiatus. So, like, you know, maybe in a few years, if I really have something to say, maybe I'll record one. But for all intents and purposes, it's essentially the last one. Yeah. But I mean, every time I've had you on, people are, you know, really love the episode. So it was a no-brainer for me to have you on this episode.
Well, hey, listen, I appreciate it. And look, now I'm just a curious guy. Like, for you, was it just you wanted to get to that number 100 and then?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And that's, you know what? Because as you know, like when you follow the senators, like people like you and I do, there are dozens of podcasts out there like that. And then some of them just only make it 8 episodes or 10 episodes. And then they realize the amount of work it takes to put a podcast together. It's not as simple as, hey, let me just turn on my computer and hit record and go. There's a lot of planning And it takes a lot of your, your mental energy, right, to put into this. And so, hey, listen, if you feel like it's time for you to take a break from it, I think that's probably the right call. Here's what I think you should do, though, Trevor. I think you should say the next episode of Cost Per Point will come on the day the Senators clinch a playoff spot.
Ooh.
How about that?
So next April, right?
Well, whenever it is, next April, 2 Aprils from now.
You know what? Whatever. Not a bad idea. Not a bad idea.
And I will gladly be a guest on the clinching day.
Yeah, I kind of like that, you know, because as you say, it definitely is time consuming. But yeah, if it was like a, you know, in a year or two time, I'm cool with that. But I like that idea.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. Now, obviously, the biggest story over the past few months has been the passing of Eugene Melnyk. And obviously, so much to talk about him. But before we get into other specifics, how can you best summarize the 19 years that he owned the team?
Wow, that, you know what, it's a great question, right? Because I think it's a very, very mixed legacy. Is there some positivity? Absolutely, there's some positivity. There is, you know, stepping in and purchasing the team at a time when it didn't feel like there was a lot of people lining up to buy this team and keep them in Ottawa. Eugene Melnyk did that in 2003. Eugene Melnyk spent money to get Jason Spezza, Danny Heatley, you know, that core of players, Daniel Alfredson, to kind of keep them together in that 06, 07, 08 era. And you know, he did. He spent close to the cap there. I think the year that they brought Alexei Kovalev in, like, they were pretty darn close to being a cap team at the time. And they kind of went from a top six or seven spending team to a bottom five or six or seven spending team. And so I think we kind of saw the full, like, I think we saw the full gamut of emotions under Eugene Melnyk. You saw the, you know, the euphoria of some memorable and deep playoff runs, whether that's 07 and going to the cup, whether that's Hamburglar in 15, the great run in 17. I love the two playoff runs that I think get overlooked are in 2012 and 2013, the kind of pesky Sens edition. So, you know, I think we certainly saw as high points as we've seen in the 30 years of this franchise. Some of the highest points came under the ownership of Eugene Melnyk. And then the simultaneous part to that is I also think we saw some of the worst parts of this, you know, fan experience in the stewardship or under the stewardship of Eugene Melnyk. And so we're talking about the exodus of star players. We're talking about disconnects with legacy players. We're talking about, you know, the stuff that Katie Strang, myself, and Dan Robson, I think, did a pretty good job of detailing, you know, some sort of, we'll call it toxicity in the workplace. You know, things that I don't believe that people in Ottawa necessarily stand for. Were happening and happened under his watch. And so there was a lot of things. I think broken relationships, like, if you're asking me if you could summarize the Eugene Melnyk era in two words, I think broken relationships comes in because it's not just Daniel Alfredson and Chris Phillips and Eric Carlson and you know, Stone. It's business people. It's season ticket holders. It's staff members. It's politicians. It's media members. It's, you know, go down the list. And I'm hopeful that we're, you know, Trevor, we're at the precipice of a new era here where we can put some of those hurt feelings in the past, that it's time to repair relationships. And I'm hopeful that that's the case, but man, it was a wild run. That's a 19 year run under an owner that, I don't know that any other team in Canada, maybe even in all the NHL, had as colorful, as controversial, as fun at times, as negative at times, two decade run as Ottawa just had under Eugene Melnyk.
You know what? I think, like, pound for pound in terms of how big of a city Ottawa is, which isn't very big compared to other markets, I think pound for pound, they had the most newsworthy things coming out of the team, right? Like you said, just there's so many things, positive and negative, and controversies and stuff that came out. So I just feel like, and even today, like, I would say it's a never-ending, you know, never-ending stories. And it's just, I feel like it's... it's never a bland time to be a Senators fan, really.
No, and you know, it's funny, right? Because it, externally, now, are you still on the West Coast? Like,
yeah.
You're out? Okay, so, like, I mean, but, like, even the perception where you are of what Ottawa is as a city is we're very dull, we're boring, mm-hmm. we're the government, we're right, we're the town that Fun forgot, we're the, you know, government town where you send your taxes to and, yeah, you know, all that stuff. Well, I would argue that, you know, from an entertainment perspective, like you said, almost from a juicy storyline angle, this city provided as many juicy storylines for NHL fans as any other franchise in the last, you know, 7-8 years where there was that one period from, you know, and it was probably right in that Uber incident window, Carlson, Hoffman, you know, Randy Lee was in
just
there.
An insane window.
Did you not feel like every day is probably a stretch, but like, you know, every week you'd like kind of open up Twitter and be like, I wonder what's going to happen today.
Yes.
Like, it was crazy. It was unhinged lunacy there for, you know, whatever, 6 months, 8 months, 12 months. And it really feels like it's calmed down. It absolutely feels like it's calmed down, but there was a window there where it was like, man, this is like the New York Knicks or, you know, pick a franchise that always seems to be in the news for negative reasons. That was Ottawa for a short period of time there.
Well, yeah, and I remember reading an article, I think maybe around 2018, 2019, and I can't remember, it might have been like The Ringer or something, but it was like quite a big American publication, and they had an article about how Eugene Melnyk is the worst owner in professional sports. And like, so this wasn't just a local thing or a even an NHL thing. It was a thing that was, you know, talked about a lot over, you know, across North America. But obviously, as you say, like, sort of has this, you know, controversial, well, not controversial, I guess, but just weird legacy where obviously he saved the team and all that stuff. But I'm curious about this article that you briefly mentioned earlier. And of course, I'm sure most people listening have read already, but that was with Katie Strang and Dan Robson. And first of all, it was an excellent piece with some fascinating stories. And I'm not sure if you're like at liberty to discuss everything. And I'm sure other parties that answer those questions weren't at liberty as well. But do you think that article is essentially just kind of like the tip of the iceberg in terms of what went down over the past two decades?
Yeah. You know what? It's a great question. I don't think that everything, that we reported is the whole story. So yeah, I mean, now whether or not you want to say it's the tip of the iceberg, you know, do I think it was like, you know, if I'm going to put a percentage on the iceberg that we kind of exposed, yeah. I'm going to go to about 40%, 40 to 50% of what kind of, you know, was probably like, let me put it this way. There's more to that story. And it, to me, it's a fascinating tale. Like Eugene Melnyk to me will go down in history as one of the most controversial owners. And I think in a lot of ways, Trevor, he was a throwback to an era where sports owners were larger than life and kind of singularly dominated the news cycle. So think George Steinbrenner, Harold Ballard, Marge Schott, you know, these owners that were just, you know, I would put Jerry Jones on that list. Like, owners that, like, when you think of them and the team, they're synonymous. Like I always say this to people, like, can you, and I'll ask, you're a huge hockey fan, right? Like, you're a huge hockey fan. Can you picture what Jeff Vinnick looks like, the owner of the Tampa Bay Lightning?
No, not at all.
You have no idea. You have no idea what Jeff Vinnick looks like, and neither do most people in the hockey world. Like passionate fans like you and me don't know what Jeff Vinnick looks like. So that's where Eugene was different. Like, Eugene was the guy who just, you know, he craved the spotlight. He craved the attention. And so, to me, he was a fascinating character. And we worked on that story. And I know, and listen, you want to ask me about the timing? I'm more than happy to talk about any element of of the story. I don't ever want people to think that I, you know, man, Ian got really weird and quiet when, you know, Trevor asked him about this. Or no, not at all. Not at all. Like I think this stuff is really important. And, you know, we worked on that for several months. And obviously, you know, Eugene's poor health was something that came across our radar and we were aware of it. But we were always pursuing one thing and one thing only, Trevor, and that was the truth. And my biggest regret in all of it is we couldn't get all of the elements together in a time in which we could have put him or held him to some degree of accountability while he was still kind of cognizant, healthy, and able to answer these types of questions. I think by the time we got to it, and I know that there's people out there saying, like, you waited till he passed away to drop that story. Like, no, we didn't. Like, it just, I want people to understand the difficulty of trying to put a story like that together. Like, look, ask Katie Strang. Katie Strang, who's far more versed in investigative reporting than I ever will be, will tell you that was one of the most challenging stories she's ever had to overcome because of the institutional barriers that were put up by the team, by ex-employees, people that were just scared to talk because they didn't want to be sued. And then I see people saying, like, oh, Ian and Katie and The Athletic was afraid. They were just afraid of being sued. Like, no. We were never – I want to make this really clear. Like, we were never afraid of being sued because you can't be sued for the truth. But you got to prove the truth. Like, you can't just come out and say, like, well, I heard that Eugene Melnyk did this, or I heard that these people didn't get that, or what. You can't come up with conjecture. You have to come back with full-on – you got to come back with full-on facts. Journalistically, your piece has to stand. And that requires, like, multiple sourcing on things. You can't hearsay, conjecture, and rumors don't fly. So it was fascinating to me to try to put that story together because, you know, people would hang up the phone on us and say, like, yeah, I'm not talking to you. Or other people would say, like, I'd love to help you, but I can't. Or, like, it was just, you know, honestly, I think back to it, and it was really a – I think it's made me a better reporter, but yeah, you know, it was certainly a story that we had to dig and dig and dig to try to get to the truth. And even what we exposed, just to go back to your original question, I don't think we exposed everything that happened under his ownership of the team.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I'm curious what you would say to people, because it seems like there were, I would say, majority of fans understood the timing and they understood that, you know, it needed to be said. But, you know, there were some, even, I won't say names, but, you know, even some media members that were annoyed at this story. And so I don't know, what would you say to those people who are sort of annoyed at the timing? And, like, are you frustrated that there were a select few, not a ton, but a select few who were sort of coming at you for that?
Oh, no, not at all. I knew when we were getting close to putting that story out that at whatever point we put that out, we were going to take some heat for it. So I understand it. Like, I also don't want people to think that, like, you know, we put the story out and I don't want to hear about your complaints. Well, no, I understand it. Like, I understand the optics. Like, yeah. I'm intelligent enough to know that the timing of that looks awfully suspicious, right? Like, let's be honest here, whatever, 17, 18 days after he dies, this story comes out. So I understand it. Like, I completely understand it. The thing I would say to my critics, whether they're in the media or otherwise, would be two things. Number one, I would say nothing that we reported was not true. Like, everything we reported was multiply sourced, 100% accurate, not a single detail out of place. Like, not a single I was not dotted or a T was crossed. Okay. So I think if anything was in, I think that there would have been legitimate grounds for criticism if our reporting was erroneous or inaccurate. I think that, yeah. I honestly, Trevor, that would have crushed me if we put that story out and a day later the senators and people came out and said, hey, this is wrong, that is wrong. Because then it kind of throws your entire reporting into jeopardy. So the first thing I would say is to those people, look, everything we reported was true. Okay? Everything we reported was true. And so when you realize that everything we reported was true, the next question is, why didn't this come out earlier? And that's the question every media member needs to ask themselves. Why didn't you pursue this story? Why? Why didn't you pursue this story? That's all I would say. And, it took me, you know, 7, 8, whatever it was, months to try and get to this with the help of two other senior reporters who are far more, like I said, well-versed in investigative reporting and deep dive reporting than I ever was. This is my first kind of venture down this road. But my question would be, I think collectively, we all need to be accountable to people like you, Trevor, and Senators fans. Why didn't we do this story earlier? Like the big takeaway I have, Trevor, is not why did this story come out so late? The question is, why didn't it come out earlier? And therein lies the great philosophical question about media coverage of teams, journalistic objectivity, access to players, access to executives, transparency. It's a really interesting case. And I said this on, I think I said it in a live room at The Athletic, or maybe it was on another podcast. I can't even remember now because it all kind of jumbles together. But the one thing I will say is at some point, I would love for some journalism school, and I'm a Carleton guy, so you know Carleton would be the place, but I would say, hey, Carleton or Ryerson or Columbia University or Syracuse or some place with a really renowned journalism school, I would love for them, somebody to come and do an investigation on the media coverage of the Ottawa Senators under Eugene Melnyk. And why did it, like, how and why did it get to this place? Like, I'm fascinated, and I don't want to throw stones. I hope people don't understand. Like, I'm trying to out people. Like, I just, like, I'm to blame here. Like, I'm as much to blame as anybody. Like, and so this is what I want to make very clear. I don't want to point fingers. I want to take responsibility, and I want to let people know, like, hey, I should have done this sooner. I waited till whatever 2021. To kind of pursue this story. Like, why wasn't I doing this in 2019 when it was obvious that there were red flashing lights, that something's wrong under the hood? I ignored it. And I'm willing to apologize for not acting sooner. And the times that I did try and call the organization out, I think we've all seen kind of the backlash I got. And you know, it is what it is. But I would be open to, hey, let's all have a debrief. Like, let's all get into a room and say, like, what the bleep happened here? How did it get to this point? And then more importantly, how do we make sure that this never happens again? How do we, like what bothers me, Trevor, as a person of color, is that there was some racist stuff that went down and some misogynistic stuff that went down. And some homophobic stuff that went down. And that was on my watch. Like, and I say my watch, meaning, like, I covered the team while that was going on. Did you see anything from me? You didn't. And that's embarrassing to me. I am. I'm embarrassed that that stuff happened on my watch. And I hope that other people who cover the team feel the same sense of, hey, I let the city down. I did. I know I did. And my vow is I'm not going to let it happen again. I apologize that it ever got to that point. And I hope that the people in power moving forward will hold themselves to a degree of accountability to the fans to say, no more racism, no more homophobia, no more misogyny, no more of that stuff that obviously was prevalent there. That the media, in order for the stuff like that to happen, Trevor, media has to be complicit. And I mean that in that you don't do your job, which is what I like. If we did our job, which is to call out this stuff, this doesn't happen. It doesn't get this bad. But we just kind of were like, wow, that's Eugene, or that's the way they do it, or whatever. Like, we wanted to guard our access to the team. That's not the right way to do it. So I would love to, like I said, love to get in a room with all the, you know, 8 or 10 media people who have covered this team in the last decade, you know, fairly closely on a beat or what have you. The PR people that have been there, the general manager, let's all get into a room and say, what happened here? Like, and more importantly, don't point the finger at somebody. Just step up and say where you think you would be better. And that's what, you know, I'm trying to convey that here. that's what I would do. So it's really interesting to me the way that this all happened. I hope that we vow to be better. Like, because I think what we're doing, we're demanding, like, the organization has to turn the page, and I hope the organization is better. Well, I damn well hope people like me in the media are going to be better moving forward too. Like, this can't just be like the media's, like, we're really good at doling out criticism. We're not so good at taking it. We're not so good at looking in the mirror. And that's what I want us to do collectively as a group. Let's look in the mirror. And if people want to, you know, lob some insults at me and bombs, that's totally fair. Like, I get it. Like, I understand where you're coming from. And I'm telling you, I hear your criticism. I'm taking it and I'm using it as feedback, and I'm going to be better moving forward. I just kind of hope everyone can kind of do the same thing.
See, I think that's fascinating that you're giving yourself flack for this. And, you know, I do appreciate that you're putting yourself at a, you're giving yourself a high standard. And, you know, if anything, I found that your coverage at The Athletic has been, you know, the most, it's not like you've been unfairly critical of the team, but you've just told it like it is. You know, not every media member in Ottawa has done that. So I think I and lots of other people have really appreciated the fact that you're just sort of had laid it out in the past. And, you know, hopefully, as you say, in the future with whoever's owning the team, it can continue to be like that and sort of more open and transparent. It seemed like a big theme of Melnick's tenure was that he really couldn't take criticism very well. It just seemed like, you know, you heard some stories about Melnick and you know, wanting to shut things down or coming after people who were criticizing him and things like that. So I don't even necessarily blame people like you who, you know, didn't want to talk about certain things, but, you know, having that sort of high standard is always good. And I sort of also wanted to transition to a question about the future of the team then. And, you know, like what you think the most realistic scenario is here, because obviously Anna and Olivia Melnick, it's up to them to, you know, what they want to do with the team, but like, is there an actually a realistic scenario that they continue fully owning the team? Or do you think they're going to have to bring in some people to sort of help them along and at least, you know, where there's some fresh new faces, even if they're still either majority or minority owners?
Yeah. Like, so if you're asking me like, hey, what do I think will be the, like, and let's go to a year from now. So let's go to like, you know, whatever, let's even say June 1st, 2023. Like, what do I think the ownership structure of the Ottawa Senators will look like? I think somebody, another entity or party, will be the majority owner, Trevor. And I do think, and I'm going to put the number at 10%, and, you know, we could probably go 5% either way, that there, like, I wouldn't be shocked if there's some sort of legacy stake for the Melnick family there. Mm-hmm. So that's my super duper educated guess here at the end of May of 2022, is that they'll give up majority ownership. And I think it's going to be interesting because, and I've reported this a couple of times in The Athletic, at least in the print side of things, that, you know, and these are from firsthand conversations. This isn't from, I heard from a friend of a friend. And like, these are firsthand conversations with groups that I know are interested in purchasing the team and keeping them in Ottawa and, you know, possibly looking at a downtown arena and all that stuff. Like, I know of multiple groups. Like, I see people saying there's 6 or 7. I don't know about that. I'm very comfortable saying multiple groups. My question becomes, do the Melnick daughters, do Anna and Olivia decide, let's put it on the market and try and kind of, you know, raise the value here? I also think that if they do get to the point where they do slap the for sale sign on the team, I think Gary Bettman handles the sale. That I feel very confident saying that if they do decide to go down that road, Gary is in charge. Like, in fact, I would argue that Gary's probably running this or steering the ship now more than we can ever imagine. And so my guess is they're going to try to figure out how they can work with somebody to, you know, maximize or, you know, kind of monetize the team to the best of its ability. I do think that there is a real push to try and kind of get LeBreton Flats approved through the hockey club. And I think a lot of it is they want to frame this as one of Eugene Melnick's last acts was look, he got LeBreton done. Look, like on February 28th, he signed the letter or whatever the date was, and they put in the bid. And shortly after he passed away, they accepted the bid. And while I understand the thought behind it, I personally don't agree with it because I believe that he kind of submarined or torpedoed the original bid. Like, that's just my opinion. Like, I based on the conversations I've had, I feel that they had a deal in place, and I think it got torpedoed. But if that's important to the family that they want to frame it that way, have at it. But I think when you get to the point where there is an arena that needs to be built, you're going to need to bring in partners. And so yeah. It's going to be really interesting, Trevor, to watch this unfold. I think we're in for better days with a fresh outlook on this team, and it's hopefully an exciting time for Ottawa fans in the next 12 months or so.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Absolutely. I think every single fan, maybe people in Canada wouldn't want to rink in LeBreton, but I think everyone else would. And yeah, like you said, I think it would be cool for Anna and Olivia to sort of have that legacy status. And, you know, if they want to be around the team, they can. I think that'd be pretty cool. They can sort of be young faces for the team. And man, it's just very exciting thinking about the possibilities of you know, several groups coming in or at least bidding on the team and having a huge impact on this team in terms of its financial resources. And one final question about Melnick here, because obviously there's so much to discuss here. But so you touched on your personal relationship with Eugene in the article, which was, you know, complicated because several years ago he would be checking in with your family. And then the last few years of his life, he hadn't been returning any of your messages. Did you ever take that personally, or do you just sort of see that as part of the business essentially?
You know, I think it's a good question. Like, and I did. I had a really good, like, Eugene treated me so well for so many years. Would, you know, constantly text with me or email me or connect with me and be a guest on my, whether I was on Sportsnet, be a television guest on TSN 1200, be a radio guest. And then I think the tipping point for our relationship was probably the outdoor game. And I think I was, in his opinion, I was overly critical around that time about the direction of the franchise. Did I take it personally? No, because I think there's a pattern there. If you look at, you know, my relationship with Eugene, it's a really good example of how most of his relationships went in Ottawa, where it started out really well with somebody and then it just, for whatever reason, it went off the rails. So if I was by myself on an island, I would probably think to myself, like, ah, damn, did I do something wrong? Was I unprofessional? But when you look around and you're like, well, there's Daniel Alfredson and there's Cyril Leader and there's, Jim Watson and there's, go down the list of people who had good relationships with Eugene. It evaporated. Jim Little, Tom Anselmi. You know, I could go. You know, we all know we all know that. I'm thinking of the picture there of, you know, everybody that's been kind of, you know, out with the Sens. You know that picture of everyone.
I'm
having a hard time thinking of what that meme was. But anyway, you know what I mean. So, like, I don't feel any sense of personal bitterness. I understand that human beings are complicated, and Eugene Melnick was complicated. I don't think he was pure evil. I think there was a lot of good in him. And I think it's a battle between good and evil in all of us, right? Like, not all of us are inherently good people, and not all of us are inherently bad. Like, there's often the little battle that we have, the internal struggle, and sometimes the bad side wins out more often than the good. And I think that's what happened to Eugene towards the end. I don't think he was ever really the same, unfortunately, after he had the the liver transplant. I think it probably altered his behavior a little bit, and I don't think he was ever the same. And so I never took it personally. The last time I think I reached out to him was probably, I think it was 2019 going, it was like December of 2019 going into 2020. I just sent him a text, or it might've been an email now. I can't, to be honest. Actually, I think it was an email. And I said, listen, just, I know our professional relationship has, you know, kind of fallen apart. I just wanted to take a moment to wish you and the family happy holidays and, you know, hopefully wishing you all the health in the future. And, you know, hopefully we can reconnect. And, you know, I never heard back from him, and that's okay. I don't take that personally. I don't take it personally if his daughters don't ever have an interest in speaking to me after our reporting. I understand it. I'm okay with that. I just want to be somebody who's known for pursuing the truth. And sometimes it sucks that the truth has to be so negative and has to be so full of emotions and stuff. But I'd rather be known for the guy that pursued the truth than the guy that pursued relationships. And so if I had to lose a couple of professional relationships to pursue the truth, I'd rather do that. And so that for that reason, I don't necessarily take it personally with him.
Right. A fascinating 19 years owning this team. Like I said, we could have an entire episode just talking about Melnick. But so I really, really appreciate your thoughts on him there. Now, moving to the team, which, I mean, we're in the offseason now. There's a lot to look forward to with the draft and free agency. Now, the first thing is the draft, of course. And the Senators hold the 7th overall pick. Are you getting any indication as to what they're hoping to get there in terms of a position, or if they might even want to deal it instead?
So I think this is interesting. I know Pierre Dorion, I haven't even had a chance to listen. I know Pierre Dorion was on TSN 1200 on Wednesday and kind of was asked about this exact question. I do think that his answer was something along the lines of, we're open to moving the pick if it makes us better right now. Right. And so then the names come up, the Kevin Fiala is the big one, and go down the list and think Brock Besser, or, you know, whoever you think might be that elite winger. I'm of two minds on this one. Is that I understand making the move, and I would probably endorse a win now trade. The only way I wouldn't endorse, like, and I'm going to use Fiala as the example. If you're going to trade away that 7th overall pick, you better make sure that the entity you're trading for has some sort of term on his deal. And I think 3 years, like, anything 2 years or shorter is not enough for me to give up a first round top 10 pick. But if the guy has 3+ years on his deal, then I'm okay. I'm okay with it. So that would be my only caveat. I go ahead and make the trade. Go ahead and try to win now. I think Pierre Dorion and DJ Smith are at the point in their contracts where they need to win now. They don't get another free space on the bingo card. They got to win now. And I think they both men know the only way they're going to win now is to have a better roster for next season. And that means probably giving up some future assets.
Well, that's the thing that you touched on too, right? Is in your article from a few weeks ago, saying just how rare it is for both coaches and GMs to miss the playoffs this many times in a row before getting fired. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there had been a GM that had missed the playoffs 6 years in a row without getting fired. So, like, to me, this is the time to act. I don't think they need to necessarily, you know, move the farm or something, but getting someone like Fiala would be huge, and doesn't necessarily have to be exactly him. But yeah, like, I just don't know how they can, I don't know how they can go into the offseason and not act with some urgency, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm blanking on that that article, but I know that if the Senators miss the playoffs this year coming up and Dorion keeps his job, or regardless, he would be the first general manager to oversee a team to miss the playoffs in 6 straight years in the cap era. So think about, like, the salary cap era is a pretty competitive era where, you know, general managers often don't get, you know, 5, 6, 7 years to implement a plan. So this would be unprecedented in the cap era. And I do think that there is some pressure on them. And I almost feel like they kind of got to come out of the gates fast, right? Like let's say in the first 20 games, I kind of feel like they have to have 10 wins. Like, and I don't care if they're 10-7-3, great. But I feel like they have to have 10 wins. I feel like anything, like if they have anything fewer than 10 wins, if they're coming out and they're like, they're 8-9-3, or they're just kind of scuttling along, I don't think that's going to be acceptable. I think there's going to be a lot of people saying something's got to give. And so that's going to be really interesting to see. Cause I think when there's pressure for you to perform right off the hop, that means that there's pressure for you as a general manager to construct an optimal roster in the summertime. Like, you don't get 25 games to tinker. Like, you got to come out of this October 6th or whatever the opening date's going to be and be ready to go.
For sure. And I guess, well, I kind of want to talk a bit about some specific names afterwards, but just getting back to the draft for a second as well. I don't know if you've like done a whole lot of research. I know personally, this is probably the least I've known about any draft, which is strange considering Ottawa is such a high pick, but I don't know. Has there been anyone that you have sort of gravitated towards in terms of who you think would be a good fit for the Sens?
Well, you know what? It's funny because we kind of had to do a mock exercise with the Athletic on the day of the draft lottery, right? So everybody who was kind of in the draft lottery mix there had to make a pick, and it kind of got to me, and I'm looking, and I'm like, you know, there's a couple of defensemen near the top of the list. I think it was Simon Nemec and Jurecek. Jurecek. I don't think that they'll be around like when Ottawa picks. Like, I could be wrong. Like if you're asking me if they're there, I think you'd take them, because as we've learned here, like, you just can never have enough high-end defensemen. But the one guy that I find kind of interesting is the Kemmel, Joachim Kemmel, yeah. The kid out of Finland. He's a guy that I think came out of the gates, like he exploded out of the in that Liga last year, the Finnish Elite League there, and he was like the best player in October. He was like the youngest player to win player of the month. Then he had a shoulder injury and he kind of went away, but the feeling is like the real Kemmel is the kid you saw in October, and a lot of scouts I think were like, yeah, you know what, I think he's got the speed, the skill, and you could probably be a top six guy. Like, that would be the guy I would look at, because I don't know that you're going to get some of the other guys that, you know, might be, you know, potentially on the radar there will probably end up going before Ottawa picks at 7.
Yeah, I definitely like Kemmel as well. I think he would fit perfectly behind Drake Batherson or ahead of Batherson potentially later on. Like, I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of guys potentially. And I mean, obviously you want to go with best player available, but it seems like there's not much of a consensus, and as we know, the Senators never really go with that consensus guy anyway. I feel like I should mention a couple guys from the States who, I mean, we know they love taking players from the U.S. development program or the USHL in general. There's guys like Frank Nazar. I think he could be fantastic pick potentially on the wing. And then two names, Ian, my two favorite names from the draft: Cutter Gauthier and Rutger McGroarty. What fantastic names. Oh. And they're both good players.
My God, we need Rutger to make the team and play on line with Angus Cruikshank.
Yes.
Right? Like, this would be unbelievable. But it's funny that you bring up Frank Nazar, because like, I think if you looked at like, and again, I'm not as familiar with this. I'm with you. I'm not as familiar. I'm just kind of getting my feet wet on this draft class. But like, if you looked at like the, like kind of a boxes that you check for Senator scouts, like you, like the adjectives you heard about the Nazar kid are always like, you know, he's tenacious and, you know, kind of plays a good two-way game. And it, like you said, he's a national development team guy. And I know, I think he's in Michigan. I think he's committed to Michigan.
Yeah.
But like, again, like the scouts are like, you know, he's probably got kind of second to third line offensive skills, and maybe he'll top out as a second liner, but he's going to be projects out safely as a third liner. I'm like, yeah, this guy seems exactly like the type of guy Ottawa would pick. And I'm not saying that in a bad way. Like I think they've Shane Pinto is a great example of a guy that they drafted. And at the time people were like, oh, Ottawa reached on Shane Pinto. And hey, I think he's sort of proven himself. I mean, obviously Ty Boucher is one that is going to be under a lot of scrutiny in the years to come. But let's keep our fingers crossed. And I know if this is famous last words for me. Let's hope this is the last time they're picking in the top 10. Like, yeah. I don't know that I can say that with any degree of certainty, but let's hope that this is the last time that we're kind of paying attention to the top of the draft in this particular fashion.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, yeah, they really can't. I mean, I guess if they got like Connor Bedard next year, if they moved up really high and won Bedard, that'd be fine. But then again, like, I also want to make the playoffs. So yeah, it's the rebuild should be over, and it'll be fascinating to see which guy none of us expected them to take, they end up taking. Which, as you said, I mean, it could be a Pinto scenario where he ends up being a lot better. You know, maybe it ends up being a Boucher situation where, although he could be an NHLer, I don't know, I'm not really loving that pick 1 year later. But nevertheless, they've proven that they can take guys who are sort of under the radar. So I honestly have no idea where they're going to go, and it'll be very interesting to see which guy that they value higher than most other scouts.
Yeah, I agree. And look, I want to get, like, Tyler Boucher is such a, like, he's such a, like, he just strikes me as a really upbeat, fun kid.
For sure.
In the times that I've dealt with him, like, I just want to see the kids have a fair chance. And it's a lot of pressure. What I feel really bad for him is that, like, he didn't ask to be drafted 10th overall, right? Like, it's not like, you know. Yeah. He was one of these guys, like, please, like, obviously every kid wants to be drafted as high as possible, but it's like, you know, it's a little unfair. Like, I'm willing to give him, like, I think this year coming up for him is going to be a big one, right? Like, where we can, you know, hopefully see some development from him and a little bit of growth, and more importantly, like, just stay healthy. Like, that seems to be a concern of his, is the ability to stay healthy. I know COVID kind of bit him a couple of times, but even beyond that, it's just, you know, finding some consistency. And it's tough, right? Because you watch Columbus, for example, you're like, damn, like, Cole Sillinger looks like kind of an NHL-ready player right now. And Ty Boucher feels like, okay, he's a project. Like, there's no two ways around it. And projects work out. Projects can often work out, but it's going to take some time. And you look at Cole and Sillinger, and you think, like, wow, he probably would have played in Ottawa's lineup for a good chunk of last season.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, as you say, like, it's such high expectations being picked 10th overall. So, you know, hopefully over the next few years he can sort of refine his game. And I'm assuming, I guess he has 1 year left in the O, right?
Exactly. He's got his last year in the O, and it'd be great. I could just come in and just dominate as an overager. Like, just dominate.
Yeah.
You know, get 95 points, get into a playoff run. You know, that's the ideal scenario, I think. But then again, playing in Belleville might not be a bad thing either. So, again, I just think it's a big year for him coming up.
For sure. Now, getting back to something that we briefly touched on before. So Dorian has talked about things that they need to add this offseason, and I didn't listen to his press conference earlier today, but I did see a few tweets, and he was talking about wanting to add a top forward and a top four defenseman, which was actually kind of surprising, because although I don't think Travis Hamonic is a top four defenseman, I kind of thought that Dorian would sort of, I don't know, satisfy his needs, I guess, by getting Hamonic. Besides those, like, if Ottawa does end up getting, let's say, you know, Kevin Fiala and this whatever mystery right shot defenseman, do you think that's enough for them to be a playoff team? Or, like, what else do you think they need to add this offseason if they actually want to make that jump?
So my biggest concern isn't even what they do, Trevor, to be honest. Like, okay, so let's say they add the top six forward, a top four D. Okay. And I think the other thing is, like, get some clarity and goal. Like, get some clarity on Matt Murray and what you're doing there. Like that's a big part of it. My bigger concern is there's too big of a chasm, or like a gulf between the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah.
In the Eastern Conference, the Islanders are the only team that are kind of straddling in the middle of the non-playoff teams. Everybody else, it's like, you got to take a quantum leap forward, A, and then B, someone needs to take a quantum leap backward. Like, in order to overcome a 30-point deficit in the standings, it's going to require you improving by, you know, 15 to 20 points, and somebody else taking a step backwards by, you know, 15 points, or, you know, something in that neighborhood. And as I look at it, I don't see it happening for Tampa or Florida or Toronto. I do think that Boston is in a precarious spot where, you know, if Patrice Bergeron retires and they make some, you know, coaching decisions and things, I could see Boston being vulnerable. I could see that. But when you've made the playoffs every year like Boston has for a decade, you earn the right to be a playoff team until somebody tells you you're not. And then on the other side, yeah, listen, Pittsburgh, I think, is in for an interesting summer. Washington looks beat up. But again, they've made the playoffs for a decade straight. I'm not sitting here to tell them that they're not going to be a playoff team. And Carolina has, I think, almost pushed themselves into that same breath as the Panthers and the Leafs in that they're a perennial playoff team in the last few years. So really, maybe, I mean, the Rangers are a little bit of a funny team, but there's not a lot up for grabs in the East. Yeah. So I'd love to see Ottawa at least give it their best shot and take a swing at it. But a little bit of this is going to be out of their control because they're going to need at least one, if not two teams, to regress next season.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's definitely going to be very tough. Like, that is such a huge jump to make. And even just their bottom six still need some reworking to do. I mean, like, they had some good players make some good appearances, like Parker Kelly and Mark Hastalick and stuff. So it's not as if they don't have guys who can play there, but they definitely need some improvement. Now, in terms of actual names, like, is there anyone besides Kevin Fiala? And, like, obviously, we've talked about Claude Giroux a lot. You know, he's certainly an option in free agency. Is there anyone else that you're sort of looking at as guys who could be good options who might not necessarily be as expensive?
Yeah, like, I mean, like, I see that, like, Travis Konecny is an interesting one to me. You know, he's clearly kind of fallen out of favor in Philly. Something seems awkward in Philly with Konecny, so he'd be a guy I'd kick the tires on. I've always been a Brock Besser fan, like, if you're looking for that type of just kind of goal scoring stuff, but I know that he's got a lot of you know, personal stuff that he might want to get back kind of closer to home, that maybe Ottawa is not necessarily the best place for him. Another guy from Vancouver that I'm curious about is Connor Garland, and I don't know that I'd be willing to part with my number 7 overall pick for a guy like him, but I think he's a control of what I don't have cap friendly up in front of me, but like, I think he's got a, you know, a controllable contract for a couple of years. He's, you know, he's a guy that I see him being like a good middle six kind of guy. Like, you know, my question would be though, can he click with Timmy Stützle, right? Like that's my question. But if they're able to put Drake Batherson with Stützle and put Norris with Tkachuk, and then maybe Matthew Joseph plays up there with Norris and Tkachuk, and then maybe a guy like, you know, whether it's Garland or whoever else plays with Stützle, Batherson, maybe it'll work that way. But I'm curious how this is going to play out because, again, my only point is if you're going to give up that number 7 overall pick, it better be for somebody who's worth it and with term. I don't think Garland is worth it in terms of value, but certainly the term is probably there. But, you know, so those are just, again, top of my head, those would be some guys. It makes you wonder, like you know, a guy like Vlad Tarasenko, who was available last year, you think to yourself, like, man, like, could they have had Vladimir Tarasenko?
Yeah.
Could they have made a pitch for him? Could they have made a play for him last year when he was kind of asking for a trade? Who knows, right? Like, but the reason why I bring up Tarasenko is inevitably – there's going to be another Tarasenko this summer, right? Somebody somewhere is going to be like, I need to get out. Or I need to change the scenery or something. And maybe that's where you can try and capitalize on somebody or look at those kind of cash-strapped teams that are going to need some space and need to get rid of somebody in that $5-7 million range.
Yeah, like, I'd love to see Dorion take advantage of a team that, you know, he did it like once or twice in terms of like acquiring picks. The one I can think of is the Coburn deal where he essentially got a free second round pick. And yeah, I'd love to see him do that in terms of an actual player. I just looked up Garland's contract here. It's quite favorable. I mean, he signed at 4.95 for the next 4 seasons, and he's only 26. So, like, yeah, that is, I don't know, but because of that, Canucks might be asking for a lot. They might be asking for that 7th overall pick, which, I mean, I don't know. I feel like if, like, he got 52 points last season in 77 games, I feel like if the 7th overall pick is kind of in that 50 to 60 point range, you might be happy. So, I don't know. I'd be hesitant to move that as well, but Garland would certainly be a good option, or at least someone like that.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, I knew he was under some sort of controllable deal. Like, that would be a great deal in terms of the profile of a player, right? 26 yeah. years old, 4 years, under $5 million, right? Like, that you're really not going to get. And I think Connor Garland, to me, is like a legitimate 20-goal guy. Like, I'm not yeah. looking for like, I think that's what Fiala is too. Like, Fiala had a career year this year, but let's just assume that he is a 20 to 25 goal guy. And if he exceeds that 20 to 25, great, but kind of pencil him in for that. So it's going to be interesting. I think if Ottawa can get a player like that, an impact, ready to go, somebody who's not 32 and kind of on the downslide, but somebody like 24 to 27 to come in for a couple of years, that's to me, that's got to be plan A.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, what about, like, I haven't even thought too much about defensemen. Like, are there any defensemen that have even been on your radar? It feels like there's always way less defensemen available, of course, because teams don't want to move them and not many good ones reach free agency. But is there anyone that would even make an impact on the second pairing potentially?
Well, you see, and this is like, you know, I go back to last year when, like, Ryan Graves was the guy for me
yeah.
last year. I'm like, man, like, Ryan Graves available, trade multiple second round picks.
How about,
like,
Devon Taves too?
Yeah, exactly. Devon Taves the year before. Like, trade 2 second round picks. Like, go, just do it. Like, if you got to throw in a second round pick and a one of your young defensemen prospect, just go ahead and do it. Like Ryan Graves was sitting there last year, Taves the year before. There's going to be another guy like that this year. And you know, I should have had Cap Friendly and available in front of me, but usually you can get a pretty good sense of, you know, teams are going to get rid of you know, certain guys, or they're going to price themselves out of their situation. And like, for me, I think this is where Ottawa, like, you got one opportunity with Ottawa to kind of what's the word here? Like, exploit your cap situation, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you have a ton of cap space and there's a bunch of heavyweights that have no cap space. So now's your time to use it. Like, use it. Like, make three-way trades where you're eating cap space in order to get an asset to go. Like, whatever it is. But now's the time. And there's no, to me, there's no real excuse for not getting, you know, a top 4 or 5 defenseman and a top 6 forward, because the market will be probably full of them, or teams will be ready to trade them, and you'll have the space to do it. Like, it, to me, it's go time in Ottawa, and you know, here's hoping that they can get something done.
Absolutely, and I'm excited at the prospect of getting one, hopefully two of those players. Slightly worried about who exactly Dorin thinks those good players are, but it'll be interesting nonetheless. Now, we're talking about obviously like who they should add in the offseason, but what do you think fans should actually hope for next season? Like, what we should hope for, but also what do you think is most realistic in terms of their season outlook?
I think it's funny. I'm going to say probably exactly what I said going into this year, which was, you know, if they can get around 85 to 90 points and hang around the playoff spot until after the trade deadline, that would be a successful year. And that's what I said this year, and I'm going to say it again next year. I think everybody's tired of the you know, the poor starts and the inconsistency and all that. So mm-hmm. I'm also very cognizant that this is a stacked division and a stacked conference. Like, if they were in the Pacific division, I'd be like, yeah, they should push for a playoff spot. Cause yeah, you know what? There's no reason why they can't do what LA did this year, but I don't know. I don't know that they will. So let's go to 90 points and let's be competitive and let's be a team that doesn't sell at the deadline. But again, I feel like a broken record. I feel like I said that in 2021, yeah. 2022, and now I'm saying that going into to 2023.
Yeah. You know what? Yeah, like ultimately, if they make it close, if they're within like 5 points of a playoff spot, I can't be too mad, because as we've been talking about, like it is going to be extremely hard to make it in. But yeah, like if it's the trade deadline and they're completely out of it and like we have nothing really to cheer for, it's just going to be so disheartening. So, and I guess the one silver lining with that is that we're almost certain big changes will happen if the team fails again, because probably no new ownership. I don't think they're necessarily going to have Smith and Dorion on a very long leash. So yeah, the team could look quite different, I guess, going into 23-24 if they don't make the playoffs and they're still not succeeding.
Well, yeah, listen, like we said earlier, there's never been a general manager to oversee a team to miss the playoffs 6 straight years in the cap era. DJ Smith, if he misses the playoffs in 4 straight years, that's, now you're into some pretty uncharted territory. I think Thomas Chabot will get a little bit more restless, and I'm certainly not suggesting restless like, hey, I want out. I think more restless like, hey, give me some damn help around here. Like that. That's the message. So there's no way mediocrity is going to survive around here for another year. No way. And the bar has been raised. I think Chabot and Tkachuk made it clear in their exit meetings. The bar is going to be raised. And now it's up to the general manager to raise that bar and raise the talent level in the offseason. And then it'll be on the players and the coach to then raise that bar. But, first up on the first guy off the tee is Pierre Dorion. And we'll see what he's got in store for the summer.
Absolutely. Now, one section I wanted to briefly talk about to finish off the episode here is the playoffs. And I don't know, like I just love watching any game I can, which is kind of funny because the Senators are like the only team that I'll watch during the season, but anytime there's playoff games on, I'll be watching the entire night. Have there been any surprises for you so far, and who do you have winning it all at this stage?
Well, I mean, like at the start of the playoffs, the Athletic kind of asked us, hey, go through your wall, had to pick brackets and whatever. And my Stanley Cup was Carolina against Calgary, which is looking a little bit precarious. Well, certainly on the Calgary side looks precarious. Carolina looks like a Jekyll and Hyde team. We should have learned our lesson before that until somebody beats Tampa Bay in a best of seven series, they're the champs for a reason. And, I'm thinking, though, if there's nothing been overly surprising about the playoffs. It's been very entertaining. I've loved it. The one thing I would say is, I would love to see a Final Four. And I mean, no disrespect. Look, I picked Carolina to win the cup, so I don't mean disrespect to anybody who likes the Hurricanes. But wouldn't you love to see a best of seven series with Igor Shesterkin up against Andrei Vasilevsky? You've got a goalie that is likely going to win the Vezina Trophy for the regular season up against the goalie that a lot of people are saying deserves to be mentioned in the same breath as Patrick Waugh and Marty Brodeur and Dominic Hasek and some of these great goalies of the 90s and 2000s. And then on the other side, what about Cale Makar / Nate McKinnon up against Leon Draisaitl and Connor McDavid? If you're telling me that's the Final Four, I think that's the dream scenario for the NHL, because then go ahead and pick any combination of the finals amongst those four teams. It's going to be awesome. Tampa Edmonton, Tampa Colorado, Colorado Rangers, Rangers Edmonton. It's awesome. Everything looks good. So by saying this, I know I've now probably resigned us all to a Carolina St. Louis Stanley Cup. Now, just by saying this, we're going to get the Blues and Hurricanes in the Stanley Cup.
Man, I mean, I'm just happy that we got the Battle of Alberta, because an LA Dallas series just would have been very dull. So I'm super happy we got that. And I remember I picked, I think for like multiple years before Tampa won the cup, I would be picking Tampa every single year. And then finally I got it right in 2020 when they won. And I think the last two seasons, it's been Colorado, or I guess the last two seasons, because same thing with them. I feel like just inevitably they got to win one year. But then again, like you said, it's so hard to bet against Tampa Bay. But yeah, I feel like either way, this might actually be one of the best ratings they get for the final, just because they have so many of these superstar players, and you know, you have the new ESPN and TNT deal. So I feel like the NHL's in a pretty good spot there.
Yeah, look, like the NHL's always had a hard time, I think, marketing its stars. And part of that is, you know, the star players have generally been pretty quiet, vanilla guys, right? Like, think of Sid and think of, you know, McDavid. And, you know, some of these generational players haven't necessarily had a ton of personality. But I think what McDavid does on the ice speaks for itself. Like, McDavid doesn't have to be, you know, Steven Stamkos to me has an amazing personality. He's outgoing. He's fun. You know, Marty Brodeur had that. I think PK Subban had that. But McDavid does that on the ice. Like, that's fine. So if the game has always had a hard time for whatever reason, NHL likes to sell itself as like, we are the ultimate team sport and no one player is bigger than the team. Well, it's like, well, that's not true. Like, just look at the salaries. Like, yes, several players are bigger than their team. And Connor McDavid is one. And I think Cale Makar and Nate McKinnon are two others. And I think Shesterkin and Vasilevsky are another. Like, let's get those guys into the finals or into the final four. Let's enjoy them. Let the skill take over. Like, who wouldn't want to see some combination of those four teams I mentioned duking it out for the Stanley Cup and having some fun arguments of, hey, if you had a game 7 to win, would you rather have McDavid or Vasilevsky? Maybe we'll get the answer to that question up close and personal in a few weeks.
Man, it's going to be a lot of fun. I have a couple questions left for you, Ian.
My battery power's starting to go. So.
Oh boy, oh boy. Yeah. Okay. Just one final quick one about the Sens. Why should Sens fans be hopeful for the next 5-10 years?
I think, you know, getting Brady Tkachuk, Thomas Chabot, Drake Batherson all locked up into long-term deals is the type of security you haven't had as a Senators fan in a long time, right? Carlson, Stone, all those guys kind of left at the peak of their powers, and you're going to enjoy Tkachuk, Chabot, Batherson, I suspect Norris, I suspect Stutzla. You're going to get them for the best years of their lives. So enjoy it. Enjoy the fact that this is a fun team. Like, we talked about this earlier in the show. Ottawa, we have a reputation for being boring, plain, and Brady Tkachuk and Josh Norris and Timmy Stutzla and Drake Batherson and Thomas Chabot, Jake Sanderson are anything but dull and boring. And I think we should embrace the fact that the youth of that hockey club should represent a kind of fun, fresh start for Ottawa here in the years ahead. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. You can tell they genuinely love the city. Like, they love playing here. And I think everybody should be pretty excited about that.
It's extremely exciting. Watching this core has been a lot of fun. I don't know if you have time for this. There's one question from the Third Line Plugcast. Do you have time for this quick last one?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I'm looking at my now I have to take my laptop and charge it in another part.
Oh god. Okay.
But I'm at 6%.
Okay.
Should be okay.
Rapid fire version. Our friends at the Third Line Plugcast, they ask get Ian to share the story about the time he got a glass of milk sent to Brent Wallace's hotel room. So I don't know if you
okay, I will, but now I feel bad telling this story because I opened this podcast talking about how Brent just came over to our house and gave us a gas generator, which is the reason why I'm able to do this podcast. So I'll tread lightly here, but very quickly, 2006 playoffs, Ottawa played Tampa in the first round. If memory serves me, Marty Havlat was hurt at the end of that regular season, or something was up with Marty Havlat going into the series against Tampa, and we didn't know his status. So we're waiting in the hallway for Marty Havlat, me, Brent Wallace, his camera guy, my camera guy, some other reporters. And Brent thinks it's funny. He's swinging his TSN microphone around by its, by the wire, and he hits me right in the you-know-where, like right hard. And I go down, like, I'm in pain. I'm like, oh, my God. Like, and then sure enough, Marty Havlat walks right into the scrum. I look like an idiot. I'm double over. I can barely speak. I'm like, I'm going to get this guy back, okay? Like, I'm going to get Brent back. But I'm like, how do I get this guy back? So we go to Tampa for that series. I think we would have been there for games 3 and 4. We're staying at the Westin Hotel in Tampa. and I'm on the same floor as Brent. And we were out after a game. We come back to the room. We go to our rooms, and I wait for him to go to his room, and I go into my room, and then I pop back out of my room because on everybody's door, they used to leave. I don't think they do this anymore, and it's not even just a COVID thing. It's just they don't do this anymore. But they used to leave a little flyer on your door that if you wanted breakfast delivered to your room the next morning, you would fill out this form and leave it on your door handle. And then at like 4 or 5 a.m., somebody from guest services would just peruse the hallway like, oh, this person wants this, and they just grab it. Okay? So I decide to fill out Brent's card and leave it on his door. But I don't want to have a big breakfast. Like, that's just a waste of food and the workers' money. Like, I don't want that to happen. That's not cool. But I was like, I want this guy to be woken up at 6 a.m. So I grabbed the sheet of paper, and I just took a pen, and I clicked one glass of milk. And I picked the delivery time of 6 a.m. And so I put it on his door. And sure enough, the next morning, they came. They got it. They knocked on his door. At 6 a.m., he opens his door, and there's a guy standing there. Here's your milk, sir. And he comes to the rink, and he's livid. He's like, hey, somebody effing ordered me a glass. I gave it to that guy. I'm like, yeah. I was like, next time, don't hit me in the nut sack with your microphone. So,
oh, my God.
Yeah. So anyway, amazing, there's the – there's and now I'm down to 4%. Just telling that story, I'm down to 4%
power. Okay. So, you know what, you know, I love hearing that story, and I think we got to wrap it up there. This is a very long episode, and I really appreciate it. Ian, as always, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule and having to use a generator. Like, man, oh, yeah. We definitely didn't have to do it today, but, you know, you've always just been incredibly gracious with me and others in the Sens community. And, you know, you've been someone for me to look up to over these years, and you've also been like very complimentary of my work, which has definitely had an impact on me. So I'm very happy that I get to finish this final episode with such a respected individual, and cheers to what lies ahead.
Wow. Well, that's, you know, it's really nice for you to say that. And listen, I've certainly enjoyed like your writing is almost always bang on, and you know, you're passionate, but you're also really articulate and intelligent. That comes across in your writing, and so I always love reading your stuff, and it means a lot to me that I get to be your you know, last guest here. But like I said, here's hoping that when they make the playoffs, I want you to restart up the Cost Per Point podcast and fire it up, and I'll be your guest.
Absolutely, I can't wait for that day.
Okay, awesome. Well, listen, right. in an ode to Brent Wallace, now my battery is at 2%. Yeah, that's a milk joke. So,
all right, 2%. We can sign off right there. Thanks so much, Ian.
Hey, listen, have a great day. Thanks for having me on.
You too. Thanks. One final question that I wasn't able to get to while I was with Ian was a question from the Hockey Lass on Twitter. And she was asking, funniest moment of the show. And I don't know, I was thinking about it, and there certainly were a ton of like funny moments, because it's not like it's a super serious show, but it's also not like many moments that are going to make us laugh. But I would say the funniest or funnest in general was when Colin and I did our, what did we even call it? But like, we drafted our all-time Senators teams, and then we did a simulation with our teams against each other. And I believe I was down 3-0 in the series. Maybe it was 3-1, but I'm pretty sure I was down 3-0. And then I ended up winning 4 in a row to defeat him in that. So even though it was literally just simulating on a computer, it was quite thrilling to have that comeback. So yeah, it was great having Colin as a co-host. And just in general, I just wanted to sign off here by saying, you know, from the bottom of my heart, thank you. You know, thank you to all the listeners, whether you listened to just this episode, some of the episodes, most of them, or all 100 of them. It truly made my day when someone would leave positive feedback about the show, because I knew it was at least giving someone out there good content. And I can still remember thinking about a potential podcast name in the spring of 2016, as I wanted it to be something that only Senators fans would understand. I never had an end goal in mind with a show, but I knew I had a lot to say, and I wanted to see where this would take me. There weren't many Sens podcasts at the time, but now there are honestly so many great ones, like Ian was saying, and frankly, most of them are better than mine, and I love that the fan base has such a plethora of options out there. And being in hockey media was something that I thought could be a career option for me, although over the years I realized it was just more of a passionate hobby than anything, which is totally fine and is probably the case for most people. With that being said, although I wanted to do my best with the podcast, it became increasingly hard to be motivated since this was just for fun and I wasn't trying to bring this to new heights or anything. But bringing Colin in to be my co-host was a nice shot in the arm for the show, as he did some incredible work before the 2019 and 2020 drafts. Having him on was great because I didn't need to rely on getting other guests all the time, and we could essentially record whenever we felt like it, not to mention that I had to edit just half the time now. He, of course, needed his break from social media and following the team, and the past year and a half has certainly been more challenging in terms of producing content. I always knew I wanted to get to at least 100 episodes, so I wasn't going to stop before that. However, it wasn't always the easiest to be motivated when one show can be a whole night affair after creating a script, recording, editing, and posting it on the blog. Was I proud of the show? Of course, but at times it felt like a chore, something that I owed my audience, and that's not really what I want in a hobby. Things have changed a lot for me personally since 2016 because, as I said earlier, I used to have some aspirations for sports media as a career, but now I'm a full-time teacher and my goals are much different. I wish I could keep this going, keep getting amazing guests, and expand on this as a whole, but the reality is I just don't feel like I have the time, nor do I have the same joy that I once did from the show. I'm so happy that I got to interview so many amazing people, and I love being able to say that I got to 100 episodes, but now it's time to step back. Or, as Ian would say, at least until they make the playoffs. I won't completely close the door on the Cost Per Point cast, since I might want to have a random episode here or there over the years if there's something I'm dying to talk about, but I'll definitely be taking quite a while off, so for all intents and purposes, this is my last show. Thank you to the listeners for keeping the show going. Thank you to Colin for being a fantastic co-host. Thank you to all the great guests over the years. Thank you to Maddie GoSends on Twitter for the phenomenal logo. Thank you to my roommate and family who have had to listen to me essentially talk to myself in my room. Thank you to the Senators for always having things to talk about. Just thank you to everyone who has made this possible. And for one final time, adios.